Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Look at the screen. William Blake's The Great Red Dragon, and the woman clothed in the rays of the sun. Do you see?
I know that I'm not smarter than
you. Then how did you catch me?
You had disadvantages.
What disadvantages?
You're insane.
Do you see?
You're so sly. So am I.
Do you see?
You're supposed to be his friend, Jack. Why didn't you leave him alone?
Do you see? Mrs. Leeds, do you see?
Yes.
You want the scent?
Smell yourself.
Do you see?
Just you and me now, sport.
Do you see?
You've seen these films, haven't you, my man?
You owe me awe.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Manhunter, a Manhunter podcast where we take Michael Mann's 1986 neon noir adaptation of Thomas Harris's Red Dragon, Manhunter, and we behaviorally profile it one great, fantastic guest at a time. And today is one of my favorites, a hotly contested, everyone's best friend amongst our community, the immensely talented adjunct professor at Brown University, the co-host of the Bright War Dark Room podcast, and editor at large of all things over there. It's the legend, Veronica Fitzpatrick. Hello.
Oh my God. Hi.
How are you?
I'm so honored by that, like, florid introduction.
Well, we have now met each other in person.
I was so
touched. You were one of a series of escalating surprises for my LA trip of special guests who were special to me because we were close and had a great relationship, and then finally, as you say, took us out of the matrix and got to meet each other in person. And yeah, it was so great. We even took a late night walk through LA with friends, not unlike this walk, much less perilous, I may say, and the destination was much more
pretty
fun.
Pretty different from this walk.
A lot different, but we've actually walked together at night, which we're going to take a walk in this film. So it's just an absolute treat to see you
again. God. Likewise.
It's the best. We've had so much fun. So it's hard to dissociate how much fun and how silly I want to be with you with actually the task at hand,
which is
let's talk about a film together on a podcast. And this one.
This is kind of a silly moment from that film, though, to be fair. So
it really is. Yeah. Well, absolutely. It's paranoia, peak paranoia moment in this film. Tell me about any relationship that you've had, because I know some of the flicks that you have a huge relationship with. And when I was throwing this out there to my amazing crew of friends, you were like, yep, I'm down. I really want to talk about it. So tell me about any relationship you've had with any of the Thomas Harris adaptations, and particularly Manhunter.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a huge Silence of the Lambs fan from way back. I would say, way back to like me watching it as a kid, probably way too young on like the USA Network cable TV. And how was that version?
Was it like censored?
It is censored, but I encountered so many movies that I love as an adult in that kind of censored, fragmented by commercial format.
Yeah, TV too. Same. So absolutely.
Totally. Yeah. And it didn't detract from my experience at all. In fact, it kind of set me up for like a second revelatory encounter with those films once I was an adult, and I was like, oh, this is actually gory, or like, he, you know, there, he actually gets blood on his face at that part. But there's actually something I think more titillating to be watching it in the context of like you're in a basement or a living room. There's like Clorox commercials coming on halfway through. There's this sense of like normalcy, and then you have this really transgressive kind of film text that's yes. really dark, and it's really like taking you somewhere. So I mean, I loved that, and my mom was a big fan of the film when I was growing up too, so she and I have rewatched it a million times. I'm also maybe kind of controversially a Red Dragon 2002 fan. I think Ralph Fiennes is just like so good in it. I mean, it's like pre-Voldemort. I don't know, giving something similar, and his like you know, there's a couple moments aesthetically in that movie that really stuck with me, and that I think in my mind have become kind of like substitutes for the entire movie, which is flawed, of course, even though
yes.
it's totally insane that same cinematographer, like that's got to be a really weird experience to yeah. shoot the same, like to do the remake so many years after the original. But
the crazy element is you love Silence of the Lambs, adapted by Ted Talley, who won an Academy mm-hmm. Award, does Red Dragon as well. Hopkins, mm-hmm. substitute in. All of our other favorite actors, Harvey Keitel, Philip Seymour Hoffman, Ralph Fiennes, pre-Voldemort, yeah. Emily Watson. You know, there's a murderer's row of actors
yeah.
in that movie. And what I would say to you is, I hate it. It's a garbage dump of a movie. It makes no sense that a movie with that many talented people is so bad. But I do like what you said, which is I can be quite forgiving of a movie in my memory because mm-hmm. I'm like, if you have an Walter Chaw, great film critic, put it this way to me one day, and I really liked it, which is like, Blake, our job from if I'm ever talking to critics, our job is to like find where a movie is alive. And mm-hmm. if not, you have to structure your argument around where the movie has proof of life, or you mm-hmm. have to examine its corpse. And I feel like so much of that movie is dead, but some Ralph Fiennes moments do have life. It's like the pulse inexplicably just goes and buzzes yeah. and then it goes flat again. Whereas I think Manhunter is like watching someone have a cardiac arrest. It is so alive in so many ways.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I think there probably a lot of people who are listening to this are not in a position of having seen Red Dragon and not being familiar with Manhunter. But for people who may or may not be in that position, like, for example, the Emily Watson, like Reba scene yes. with the tiger on the table, I remember seeing in Red Dragon and being pretty transfixed by the sort of texture and the vitality of what's exchanged in that moment, and the sort of like alternative romance of that being sort of like a surprise date. And you would be delighted to discover that that scene plays almost identically yeah, in Manhunter. Right. Yeah. And so then it's like you can really appreciate the genealogy of where Red Dragon does get its juice when it has it, which I agree is like a lot rarer. And I actually think that's an Edward Norton problem. Like,
oh, yeah. He is
most of all
the blondest.
Sorry Ed Norton, to that man.
The blondest Ed Norton of all time. And you're like, why did he need this disgusting yeah. bleach? That's a year nine accident. You and I have shared, I think we even talked about having bad decisions of both bleaching our hair at different stages of our lives. It's like,
yes.
it's the worst decision. And it's now writ large in that movie, in with this blonde hair.
It is. And I mean, the other thing about the Harris adaptations, I fantasized a lot as a kid about becoming a forensic psychologist.
Oh, yeah.
And like, would say even now, there are moments when I'm dissatisfied with my academic career when I'm like, is it too late to go to the FBI and just be like, take me? Because, you know, the skill set is so the same, or at least you can have a certain fantasy that the skill set is the same in terms of cinematic representations of this kind of painstaking research, close reading, the kind
obsession.
Of like a total obsession on stuff that totally terrifies other people.
Yes.
Like being really interested in certain kinds of archival research and like visual close reading, all this like photography and weird forensic miscellany, and then kind of speculating a story out of it, which is exactly what all film scholars and like art historians do, basically. Yes. Is like make up stories about pictures.
We do
without murders, but like what if there were real stakes? That would be so amazing.
Well, that's so good. So you started there. Now take me to Manhunter.
Yeah. Manhunter, I came to a little bit later. It was more through Man.
Yes.
So I have a real appreciation for, well, obviously I have a big appreciation for Michael Mann films, and maybe specifically for the two things I'll say. One, content-wise, such a romantic. And I just am such an admirer of the kind of core of romance in all of his films and how central it is, even when it's maybe seems more minor, but it's always like really, really paramount. I really believe that. And I think that's also really true, even just in reading Heat 2.
But
the
you,
second
you,
thing.
You were so satisfied and you actually were vindicated, you personally, at the Michael Mann Q&A,
yes,
when he's like, I get lost in the romance of Miami Vice. That's my favorite part. That's where I feel like the movie takes its it takes it to its like most elevated storytelling level. And you were just,
yes,
like, preach, Michael Mann, preach.
Yeah. I was audibly like, yes, in the audience. Like, yes, filmmaker, you're right about your own movie. But yeah, like, of course it's a romance. Like, that's all of it. It's like Wong Kar Wai. It's so devastating.
That's why Last of the Mohicans. Like,
yeah,
so many people are like, oh, it's good. I'm like, have you seen the electricity that is bouncing off the screen when Madeline,
yeah,
Stowe and Daniel Day-Lewis look at each other and their hair, they look like it's so perfect. They're in a Pantene commercial. It's just like,
yeah,
it is as hot as it gets. Holy.
Yes. Michael Mann films are for people who have been in love, which I really, yes, really appreciate. And then formally, they're always so expressionistic. And
yes,
particularly with color and light. And I think that's so on display in Manhunter. And it's just awesome to look at.
It's a pretty film. It's been a marvel to do this show like this, because actually having the text as we, you know, people who are listening, it's not a traditional minute show where we just sort of watch the minute and then we spend much of the rest of our discussion, sort of like our remembering, our note taking, our research on that specific thing and trying to find angles to cut in. It's alive for us anyway, attack of all of these thoughts that we have about what we're seeing. And we're looking at a very expressionistic minute and a very paranoia minute right in the middle of Will Graham's head, like the Tooth Fairy, Dollarhide. It's just waiting around every corner and just watching that paranoia unfold. So we're going to have a really fun time watching it. I'll orient you guys to where we're going to be. So we have just done a scene where they use Lowndes to basically set a trap, hopefully, because they're trying to write awful things that are going to antagonize the Red Dragon or Francis Dolehide or Tooth Fairy, and they're using Freddie Lowndes to do so. And now Will is sort of tactfully done a rehearsal of this walk, and now he's walking and trying to ensnare him. And so this is the moment that we arrive on right now. So Veronica and I are going to start watching this beautifully expressionistic thing. the least romantic scene, and I apologize because it could have been the tiger, could have been any other scene. But we're gonna watch this scene, this very expressionistic, paranoid, formerly stunning scene of Will walking and trying to snare this guy, and we're gonna see the beautiful failure of that. But it's gonna look gorgeous. So let's get started. That's enough. I just want to pause that for just 1 second. It's 52 minutes, 28 seconds. Right from the get-go, it jumps from a newspaper in a bundle from the previous scene. We jump into this scene and just the symmetry and the mm-hmm. shadow play. It's mm-hmm. so gorgeous. What kind of wet, damp roads, you know, very Thief. It just right from the get-go, it's just like, this is going to be beautiful. And there's just a little touch of moisture in the air, a little bit of fog. It's just, I don't know. It's just this. Tasteful. This gets me. It's tasteful moisture. Not like Miami Vice. Okay, let's try and keep it above. No, we're not gonna. It's not gonna happen. But I just love this moment in this scene and the shadow play. It's so pretty. Right from the get go.
You called it, I think, a neon noir in the
yes.
beginning. And I mean, this is the sort of classic film noir sort of sequence, and not just the kind of low-key lighting that we're getting. But I think in the sound design,
yes,
this footstep that we're about to hear throughout this scene, it's like metronomic, like
yes.
the same way that a heartbeat or a clock ticking would help us understand that we're sort of under deadline. This is going to be a really critical part of the kind of tension mounting as this goes on.
There's a really stupid, and I know you would have encountered it, Instagram, maybe it's TikTok, I don't know, but I'm an adult, so I'm on Instagram. There's like a woman who goes, there's no sound in the world that's better than this. And she shakes an iced coffee and you hear mm-hmm. the ice like, and then there's another one where a woman's like, there's no better sound in the world than this. And it's a woman walking with high heel shoes. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say to anyone listening, and I'm hoping that some of our fans do this, can you just take that woman says no better sound in the world than this, and then just immediately cut to this scene with Will Graham?
Yeah, stitch incoming.
Stitch incoming. Make that happen. Please do that. But yeah, you're so right. I love that. And I think also you're so right about the heartbeat, because imperceptibly, as his footsteps speed up, and we're going to see it in the scene, mm-hmm, you have this weird, I don't know what it is. It's like physiological reaction where your heartbeat can start to mirror his footsteps. So at the faster he goes, the more that your heartbeat increases. It's really weird, but it's fantastic. It's so great. And I just love this silhouette. He cuts mm-hmm. a mean silhouette, Will Graham and William Peterson at this time. He's a spunk, right? We haven't even spoken about how he's a good looking cat at this stage of his life.
He's gorgeous. Yeah. Not just at this stage. I think he's looking pretty good in those CSI episodes too.
He's a highlight. But he wears less tiny, slutty little shorts, which people, Katie Walsh, my great co-host and dear friend, who's on Miami Vice and Miami Vice show, Miami Nice, was asking to be a part of this show. Of course, she would not be not part of it. And I think there may just be a supercut episode of every scene that William Peterson's in shorts, just to satisfy Katie. I think that's probably the fairest that I can
be. That's her minute.
That's her scene. I'm just going to stitch together this impossible scene where he's just in shorts. And then that will satisfy, I think, the entire show. I think everyone will be happy with that, most of all me.
Yeah, inseam report. I'm into it.
I love this. So there's a couple of great cuts there. Great insert of his feet hitting along cobblestones, puddles, back to him close up. It stops being a silhouette. It's him. And I love this. It's 52 minutes, 46 seconds. He's just coming past. And the reality of the trap is there, which is like mm-hmm. the great Dennis Farina cutting his mm-hmm. mean silhouette and frame in this awesome black suit and a trench coat and just a a guy, you can't even see his face. He's in complete military like SWAT gear, black rifle. It's just so like, oh, okay. They're not mucking around here.
Yeah.
They really want to get this guy.
There's so much great in this whole sequence that's happening with editing, as you're saying, the sort of like cuts, and they're about to ramp up. We're about to get like a shorter average shot length as the sequence goes on. But this moment, what we're actually going to see is this amazing camera movement where, because we've cut to a sort of semi POV shot, we're going to swivel left and catch the other sort of SWAT guy in the other kind of like vestibule under the archway.
Yeah, it's cutting. It feels like he's completely alone. And then there is some cover. It does a nice swing. Check. Another SWAT guy. Looks more human other than that complete cover. And then looking up to the blackness of the sky.
And then a huge wide. Like
huge.
It takes a second, I think, to place that archway you were just looking at the top of is actually now so small in the frame.
Yeah, it's so deep in the background. And I imagine that like it would both be easier and harder to look at on a big screen. And this must have been one of those kind of when some of our friends saw like a 70 millimeter print of this thing, it would look so magnificent on a gigantic screen.
100%.
Because you can literally, it would be crystal beautiful clarity right all the way back. And I love all these, like, there's something, I don't know whether it's charming or there's just something that has more personality, but there's this like weird lights as they get older and as they're starting to fail, they're kind of the weird like filaments in the lights and stuff start to change color, and they get, so there's this weird kind of like orangey in some of these older lights, and then there's more the classic white. I just love the personality that the lights are giving. It's all these weird, beautiful multicolors. And then the different down lights in the car park. But here it's also, no matter how much light there is and the building is all beautifully lit and all that sort of thing, there's still these pockets of darkness that just make you go, oh God, so chilling. It's 52 minutes, 55 seconds. This shot is just so stunning. And it holds there for so not such a nice amount of time.
National Theater.
National Theater, yeah. It's National Theater in the background. And I love in Michael Mann movies, he does it in Heat too. He just loves to look at like these little tiny clusters of like nature of trees sort of sitting there like in, you know, in this like usually weird, very urban areas as ominous, like the nature of that. It's like that it's concealing something. As you know, we've already seen these modernist architecture along in the show so far that then get sort of surrounded and shrouded in trees, and that's where the Red Dragon is hiding. So again, it's this other little thing that's happening where he's like, oh, the trees are the trees are another space for this guy to be hiding, if indeed he's coming.
Yeah, this is Will's kind of Red Riding Hood moment, this scene. So it makes a lot of sense that there is kind of like a evocation of forestry and what has got to be like a really hideous space to photograph.
it's not meant to be this evocative, but he somehow gets it out. Like even like newspaper garbage in the car park, you know, old crummy like sedans that people, very functional, like people are commuting to work or leaving there overnight in the car park, and here he comes through. That's another great one. There's this beautiful, it just pivots from that shot. It's 53 minutes, 13 seconds, and you just catch someone adjusting a rifle position so that you can see the reflection off of the telescope, the sight here, and all this sort of weird green reflection. They're sort of hiding in the posts there. Oh, it's so good. This is just a masterclass.
Oh, I love that.
Oh, yeah. Let's get back to that.
That's silhouette in profile, the two gunmen. It's like purely graphic, right?
Yes.
Like, we don't need to know who they are. They're just sort of like bodies in space. And this could be a moment from like an Eisenstein film. It just looks totally out of time.
Yes.
And going back to what you're saying about the color too, I mean, obviously color expressive use of color and kind of color theory is a big part of people's critical appreciation of this film, but specifically that green tone, that kind of like sickly vertigo like green tone is so, so good in terms of evoking Dollar Hyde, even though I don't think this is like a spoiler, but he's nowhere to be found. He is not actually emerging in the sting operation, but his presence is kind of summoned by this like green mist that feels otherworldly. And that in the previous scene, I think Will and Molly are kind of gazing out at when they're having this like very romantic moment on the hotel balcony.
Yes. And that's one of the major differences in the director's cut versus the theatrical cut, which is like Molly being here in this scene is the major difference. So we are in the theatrical cut because it just is more readily available, but it is a great little note that Molly is connected. And there's one huge difference between the theatrical cut and the director's cut, and I don't know which one I like more, to be genuinely honest about it, which is that Will's isolation from Molly and calling back to Molly and seeing Molly periodically in the theatrical cut shows that she's trying so hard to keep him on track. And I think in the director's cut, that's an even better job because like he needs Molly to keep him actually from going as far down that rabbit hole as possible throughout that. So there's just one major difference there, but she sort of coaches him, everything's going to be okay, and sort of keeps him on track. But I don't know, I kind of like his isolation. He doesn't have the Molly pep talk in the theatrical cut, so it's even more ominous. It's like, what the hell is going to happen? Is he going to get taken? And the first time you see it, you're like, you're genuinely terrified in this moment. And that green right from the beginning, when they even start talking about him, the green is all over the place. He's there. He's coming. He's there whenever we talk about him. But I love this scene. It's just so beautiful. And again, I think the architecture helps, as you said, to make it even more out of time. Another great shot. Great insert shot here. It's so good. It's just like someone looking, again, you probably don't need to do it, but it's just so perfect. Someone's looking down a gigantic camera lens. You see the scrunched up face.
Yeah.
And then bang, straight into night vision. A very Silence of the Lambs precursor.
Yeah, totally. Totally.
Walking through the car park and that great, you know, it's kind of like Silence of the Lambs, Predator, Manhunter. They all like around the same time started to use this cool different visions and get different POVs that were just so expressive. And here, like, he's in the green. He's living. He's in the sights. Even though it's meant to be protection, it's totally not.
So now we're going to start this kind of cross-cutting sequence where we're seeing Will and then we're cutting and we're seeing some figure like jogging toward.
And he does this great little sort of lifts his hand up as he's going to kind of like nursing a gun. So we're escalating. We go here. It's 53:17. He's looking. We get the great cut to our man who's looking at him in night vision. And here he goes. Here comes our slow motion jogger. Isn't that such a great piece of beautiful incongruity that the jogger is in slow motion?
So true. Yeah, I'm obsessed with the fact that the jogger is in slow motion, but we keep cutting back to Will.
And he's speeding up in regular
motion, but walking faster. And then this will actually reverse.
Yes.
Like, at the end of the sequence, we're going to see Will in slow motion and the jogger in regular time.
What a shot that is. 53 minutes, 34 seconds, theatrical cut. This shrouded jogger.
Yeah, it's a Yeezy campaign.
It's literally the cover of, what is it? What's the latest album that he's just on? It's like literally him on the latest cover of one of those. My God. Oh God, Veronica. That was a 20 out of 10 reference. Here comes the puddles splashing, the cuts. There's another cut back to the green. And again, straight, again, the insert of the gun, like the gun barrel coming up. We're going to just keep playing this. Someone's coming. I think everyone knows someone's coming, Will. And this insert of down to the trigger, like someone is ready to take this guy out.
Yeah.
Make a shot. Oh, God, it's so good. And I love the gun. It looks worn. It looks like it's used.
Right. Someone, it's a good point. Good prop work.
Yeah, good prop work. It's like someone's used this before and they've definitely taken this shot. So maybe that should be a comfort to us, but it's all happening so quickly unless you're doing what we're doing and unpicking it and unpacking it. It's not. It's nowhere near as affecting.
And it's really disorienting that when we see Will, we're staying so tight on his face, right?
Yes.
We don't have a sense of him as like a figure in a background. It's just sort of his expression, his anxiety, and then this actual full figure, anonymous, kind of moving relentlessly toward camera. Scary.
And you talking about POV, it's like that whole idea of Will as having this kind of extrasensory perception or this additional layer is like he's focusing on where the threat is. So he sees this guy, he's the threat, and he's focusing, he sees a hand move into a pocket and it's like, okay, well, this is going to be a weapon. And so you can see him sort of absorbing that and imperceptibly be like, okay, well, we're looking at his perspective, what's going to happen? And every other time we get the comfort of someone's watching Will, they're so far away. Like Will is in a telescopic lens and he even looks in the middle of the lens. So no one's close to him. He's just, we're getting closer to him. This guy's getting closer to him. It's accelerating. It's disorientating. It's so great. And then we hit. And then they come into the same frame.
Bizarre violation of screen direction to have Will walking toward us and then suddenly walking left, and that like from left to right is how this encounter is going to go. But then of course we get this beautiful, like almost like White House-y columned background.
And then I love that choice of Will hits the guy. Just take it back for a quick second. He hits the guy. And we don't even get to see the immediate reaction other than the man falling.
Yeah.
Then this fish truck that we have seen on the far left of frame much earlier opens up and a whole swarm of guys all run out. And we're still not quite, we're still not quite seeing anything. There's just that great, this is one of my other favorite shots here, is like as these guys run over, there's this great moment. I'm going to hit pause. It's about 54 minutes, 5 seconds where Will Graham is completely blurred on the edges of our screen, framing the screen. And we're seeing Jack. We're seeing all these other people who've been hiding in all these nooks and crannies and vestibules and sprinting towards this location. Mm-hmm. He's got his hands up, ready with his gun over this guy, and they're all running.
Don't move. That's great. So good. That cut to the tighter framing.
The rack and then focus on the
Yeah, exactly. The gun. He's out of focus. The gun is just a few degrees off of being pointed directly at camera, at us, the spectator. And that, I mean, that's like from Edwin S. Porter on, like cinematic history, pointing a gun at the camera. The camera is a gun. It's so good.
Yeah, it's and that shot, the poster art for this show is a piece of art that is inspired by this frame. And this shot is in so many Michael Mann movies. It's in Thief. I mean, you name it. There's a lot of Michael Mann movies where we'll put the protagonist or the antagonist out of focus and have their gun essentially pointing at the audience. Like the reality of violence is right in our face. Mm-hmm. It's there. And I love sometimes you can even see the color of the hollow point bullets that are in the chamber. It's crazy. There it is. That's the full focus. 54 minutes,
so
9 seconds.
So much detail. It's amazing.
It's stunning. And then hold. People are running.
The reveal. And suddenly we're in the beginning of an SVU episode where it's like, just kidding. Those are just some kids. The yeah. real body is over there.
Some poor African American gentleman just wants to go on a late night jog. He's probably got a family and kids. He probably works terrible. Like 18 hours a day. He's like, you know what? I'm going to stay fit. I'm going to go for a jog in a well lit area right in the middle of the town where there's no trouble. And I get attacked by a guy and 1,000 white cops are around.
It's not good.
It's not good. But that's what's so great in the reinforcement of the behavioral science thing so much is like, this guy's a big guy. This guy's a white guy. This guy has bleached blonde hair. Like he's got blonde hair. It's like over and over again, we have been told what the tooth fairy is going to look like.
Exactly.
And this guy is just shocked.
This is not it.
No, this is not it. And I love this moment. Don't shoot! Will.
Yeah.
Just like crouching over him. Please don't shoot this guy.
And then in this moment, it's like the space is somehow completely demystified.
Yes.
All of that darkness that we were in before, those kind of pools of black that obscure cars and even the lines, it just looks like a regular parking lot. It mm-hmm. almost gives the sense of like we were on a film set and someone yelled cut. And now yes. this is like real life and there's just sort of confused bodies milling about. Whereas previously all of that drama just deflates right away. It's amazing.
It's so good. And I just love, there's a moment here we've paused it on 54 minutes, 25 seconds. Will is furious. It's like exactly as you said, someone's ruined the cut. And mm-hmm. the first assistant director, Dennis Farina, is like trying to calm him down. And I love that the other guy in the scene, you know, our mysterious jogger, yet and never known character in this movie, is still kind of so shocked. And there's all these guys with like guns out, like, what do we do now? And this poor guy's like, what happened? Why did he knock me over? What is going on? It's just so great. He's just like so confused.
Moving in slow motion for me. I'm being mugged.
I mean, and this is why I say it is like such a silly part of the movie, because to have the movie reference its own manipulation of time by saying, yes. what are you moving in slow motion for is so good after a sequence that relies so heavily on slow motion.
Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry, sir, you were actually moving in slow motion for all of us as you were running along in your fully Yeezy fit with your black gloves and
gorgeous teeth.
Gorgeous teeth.
Don't shoot! Don't shoot! Claire!
Takes off his jacket. Love that.
Yeah.
What you moving in slow motion for, man? I'm being mugged.
What a wonderful scene.
An operation gone awry. It is. It's such a nice, I mean, if you were teaching somebody like what cross-cutting is or how it can work, those shots that relay between Will walking and then the sort of empty spaces and then the appearance of the jogger would be a really nice kind of object lesson in how that way of separating two different things into their own frames can really effectively create tension.
And also breaking the rule completely. Now that I've set up a choreography and a geography of where these people and these bodies are in space. If I want to have them collide in a wide because it's more cinematic or because I still want this imperceptible threat. Like I want to not know who it is when he's knocked down and I want to watch the swarm of people. It's like, break the rule. Mm. Who cares?
Mm-hmm.
Hard cut between something else, like disorientate. Cause the whole, I guess the modus operandi of the entire scene is that disorientation. So I love that he's just like, I'm going to break the rule at the end. But that, all of the mounting cuts of showing Will, showing our guys, showing the telescopic, it's just all those inserts. That is, it's just a true lesson of like, how do I keep going? And I always wonder this myself because I've never actually made a film. It's like when you're making it and you're like, I want this thing to happen and I want this mounting tension, I would love to see the process of like, I want this insert, I want this here, I want this. And whether that is a geographical decision and looking at the location and then going, it's going to take us too long, or do you orchestrate because you really want, he wants that close up together, but he needs to mount the tension to that spot. And it's so interesting as a filmmaker that he was so intuitive that all those inserts and things and mounting is like a lesson in how do I get this guy to be at this distance when I need him to be at this other distance where it's actually what we're going for, which is the crescendo of the scene. And how do I keep mounting that? I would love to, that's such a nerdy thing to say, but I'd love to figure out like how people's brains work to get to that. Cause it always really, really kind of floors me.
As much as I know that man is such a kind of meticulous preparer, I think you'd have to talk to the hand of the editor in the situation like that, because I'm teaching a class on editing this semester, and we just watched Bonnie and Clyde. And I'm so reminded, actually, of the final sequence of Bonnie and Clyde cut by Dee Dee Allen, where there are these like pretty strange inserts of birds in flight and then like bushes. And obviously, if you've seen Bonnie and Clyde, you know that there's guns in the bushes, but it's not just informational. It's sort of... It's juxtaposing what feels like unnecessary image information with more necessary image information, which is these two people actually being shot to death. And then here, that's how I feel about those green frames where we're seeing him through the sniper, or it's not like really a sniper, but the SWAT POV. And we're getting the color story that the film picks up elsewhere. But we don't really need those images to understand what's happening narratively or spatially. So it just does this other kind of lyrical thing, which is give us something else cool to look at in the midst of a very stressful sequence, which I love.
Yeah, it's that's the those choices. And I just like also the scrunched up faces, you know, a scrunched up face.
Yeah, that all that moment. Focus
right on that. And then a gun butt. And it's like, why did those things need to happen together? They feel like flourishes, but it's also about escalating tension. And I wonder with those shots, I'm like, so on the night, is someone in the second unit just going, I want, you know, pick me up all these other additional shots and I'll decide if I'm going to need them or not. And then an editor sitting down and going, well, here's the scene. Here's the crescendo. It takes too long. We've got to show him beat for beat along everything. And we're going to use the POV of all these other people to get there. And if that's the decision, then it's easy, you know, but it's really fascinating. I love that. And you talked about that Bonnie and Clyde scene. When I see that, it's always like that moment is all those birds and the bushes. It's like this freed, like they've been as free as wild animals. Yeah. And you start to see that freedom in those little incongruous shots. It's like, oh, they're so free. Look at them so free. And oh no, actually they're about to be shot to smithereens right now.
Yeah, it's like, what feels like hours, even though it's like a few moments.
There's a real, an editor's eye on something. And the great editors that Mann's work with, you know, Dov Honig and Billy Goldenberg and, you know, Pascal Buba and Tom Rolfe and those guys, like so many of them are amazing. Legendary editors, and so many times they see scenes and they do it. Like my favorite story is that from Heat, Billy Goldenberg actually told it, because Heat was his first major film he edited. He said that Michael cut all his favorite moments from all the takes of the diner scene between Pacino and De Niro, and they put it together, and he was like, it just played awfully because there was no matching from each person. We just took the best of what we thought from every take. And then Tom found a take that he was his favorite, and he basically anchored the whole scene with that one take. And then they showed it to me and he's like, oh, that's what I wanted. Like that's what I was going for, is their matching energies are so important because they're doing things that are responding to the other person in the frame and it's all this other stuff. So sometimes it does take an editor to go, no, it's not the favorite bits. It's actually the chemistry. And that's what you wanted.
Right. To understand what the result needs to be, and then maybe to just be trusted with the method to get there, I think is something that I'm coming across in a lot of kind of craft discourse about editors talking about experiences of working with filmmakers.
Well, that sounds like a fun course. Happy to order it at any time, just with my camera off from Australia.
Come through. Just come Heat through. Is actually our final film, so
Got
yeah,
some
you're
story.
Welcome to zoom in.
I'll zoom in. I'll zoom in. We'll talk about that after. Veronica Fitzpatrick, you're amazing. Thank you so much for doing this. It is such.
Thank you so much for having me.
It is such a pleasure and a tragedy to see you over Zoom.
I know.
We've had so much recent fun times together outside mm-hmm. of the Matrix. You're the best. And definitively everyone's best friend. Everyone's best friend. And I can just say, no, I'm sorry, guys. It's over. The conversation is done. Veronica's my best friend, Dan Mecker, if you're listening. It's finished.
You heard it here first.
You heard it here first. No, you're the best. Thank you so much for doing this. For anyone, if you want to find Veronica's stuff, the Brightwall podcast, there'll be some great New York Film Festival stuff there. You and Fran getting together. A highlight of the calendar year, international festival calendar year.
100%.
And all great episodes with great people. And obviously your writing, because you don't pop up writing as often, but when you do, it's must read time. So
thank you so much. Well, I have a couple of essays coming out for Vinegar Syndrome and some DVD booklets that I cannot specify.
That's good.
Very excited.
And so, you know what?
I'm in your hot little hands.
I'm going to tease this one because we're a few weeks away from it. I have a pitch for you guys. That is coming for an upcoming.
Really?
Issue. I do.
Okay.
And I passed it through one of your editors.
Amazing.
His name is Travis Woods.
I know him.
Yeah, familiar. Heard of him.
I know him. Yeah.
And I'll tell you what that is afterwards because I don't know if it's been approved yet. So we'll wait and see. Wait and see. But that's the thing I'm most looking forward to writing this year. So hopefully.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So, yeah, look, fun stuff coming up. And if you like Imprint Films, which you may, great Australian boutique Blu-ray label, Secretary has Veronica's most sensational commentary track. Get it?
Thank you.
Listen, watch it, laugh, live, laugh, love. And
yeah, live, laugh, love with me and Stephen Schoenberg.
Latest Michael Mann deep dive at One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to check out other deep dive series we've done on Michael Mann, go over to oneheatminute.com. You can find links to all of our previous shows, including One Heat Minute, The Last 12 Minutes of the Mohicans, Miami Nice, featuring Katie Walsh and I in all modern man movies, including Collateral, Ferrari, Black Hat, you name it, it is there, and the Jimmy Kahn Eulogy, One Thief Minute. Plenty of shows over there. If you want to support everything that we do, we'd greatly appreciate it if you checked out our Patreon/One Heat Minute. Over there, you can see weekly new releases. One Hot Take is the show there. You can also see The Decade Project, where we look back 10 years on the films that are still hanging around, currently working through 2014. They'll be on the main feed at the end of the year, but if you are a patron for as little as $1 a month, you're getting them all throughout the year. And most importantly, as this is a Min Hunter episode, Min Hunter video podcasts will be popping up. Not every single episode, but most episodes will pop up as a video podcast as a drop there, so you can watch and consume and see all of the frames and images that we're talking about in all of these episodes. Every little bit of your support helps. So sharing, talking to us online at OHM Pods or for myself at One Blake Minute on Instagram and Twitter. Thanks so much for listening.